Don't you know? We're talking about a revolution. Sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, January 2nd, 2014. Happy New Year, everybody. And here are some of the headlines we'll be looking at. As usual, it's monetary, NSA, and Obamacare all the time, all hour long. But we're starting off with monetary issues. And the first issue of the year, of the new year, is that isn't really an issue from the point of view of some investors. Stocks have moved up to, what is it, Bill, 1998 levels?
Yeah. Well, actually, today everything kind of crashed. When the market opened, everything was down by like 150 points or so. But there was a big hullabaloo at the end of the year saying that it's the best in 15 years, which means you have to go back to 1998 to find how many years we've lost in stock activity.
Now, of course, you also have to take into account the fact that even by government standards, the dollar has lost 20 cents since 1998, which means that those dollars are not worth about 80 cents each. And that's a government standard. If you take actual real inflation that the government doesn't measure, it's probably worth about 50 cents by now. So, well, you have to take inflation into account on this?
I don't see from this particular article from Reuters that they are adjusting for inflation or not, but yeah, probably not, I suspect.
So this is basically a really exciting moment that is not actually all that really exciting.
No, not really exciting. It's we don't usually do math on the thing, but on the show, but.
Well, neither does the government, so it's fair.
It's fairly simple. The whole Fed policy of pumping money into the economy creates inflation, which is invisible, but it's also keeping interest rates down. And so what's been going on for the past 2 years at least during the quantitative easing is that banks can only lend, according to the new financial laws, to the most worthy lenders, the most worthy borrowers. So all the big corporations in Wall Street have been buying up their own stock. So what happens when you have a flat demand and the number of stock issues that are available for sale to the public goes down? Well, the price goes up. So all of the upside is purely a consequence. And this was something that's interesting. The debt-to-equity ratio for large corporations is now at 56%, the highest it's ever been in the history
wow.
of the country.
That's huge.
So they borrow all this money, they buy up the stock. Now, that causes the stock price to go up simply because there's the same amount of money seeking out a fewer number of shares. But the benefit that the large investors and the big financial investment houses get is that all of their profits are become capital gains, and so they pay lower taxes. So all of this stuff stimulates the stock market. It's creating a bubble, and as soon as they start doing easing, which they're sort of doing beginning this month, but we'll see what the effects are over the next 3 months. It could be the worst stock market in history.
So you're saying that they're going to ease the easing?
Yeah, well, what do they call it? Not trimming, but tapering. They're going
tapering.
To taper off,
right.
Yes. They announced last month that they were going to taper off about 10% from their $85 billion in quantitative easing, which is just money that they print up, and they go and buy U.S. Treasuries, and they buy Fannie Mae mortgages and things like that. But the money gets into the system, and interest rates are still at zero or as close as they can get to zero. And so all the big corporations can borrow as much money as they want to, and that's what they've been doing.
And, of course, it's also the reason why the dollar is now worth 80 cents or actually probably closer to 50 cents because of all that quantitative easing.
Well, I've never understood. You know, it's always puzzled me why inflation was considered a beneficial thing. In other words, zero inflation, apparently no government economist wants zero inflation. They want to get to 2%, they want to get to 2.5 or 3% inflation, whatever it is. That's per year. So every year, people who save money are losing 2 to 3% of the value of the money that's on deposit. The actual number of dollars doesn't change, but the value of those dollars goes down. And after mulling it over for some time, I figured out that the only reason that they have, that they consider inflation a good thing, is because it increases the flow of money. In other words, there's more money out there, so there's more money moving around. Well, every time money churns or passes through your hands or my hands or to your local business or whatever it is, every time it changes hands, the government gets to add on this little thing called a tax. And the faster it moves, the more taxes they collect.
Well, I think we also have Milton Friedman to thank for this wonderful little phenomenon, because he's the one who pretty much justified it, saying that the economy doesn't grow when the money supply doesn't grow, and he cited all his data to prove his theory, even though the data that he was pointing to was itself poisoned by the fact that the monetary system was being manipulated.
I couldn't cite Friedman. I know there were a lot of things that he got wrong, but there were many things he got right. So I don't know.
Friedman was real big on the idea that the money supply should grow. I think he actually believed that it should grow at a relatively slow rate just to make sure that the economy keeps growing, whereas some people say it also should be growing at the same rate that the population is growing. I don't think he fell into that category.
The whole idea that we could be paying for gas with pennies. Literally. And when I was a kid, I was buying gas at 15 cents a gallon.
And pennies could be worth something.
Right. So why would 10 times more or 1,000 times more pennies make anything better? It's just that I'm paying 1,000 times more pennies for my gallon of gas.
Well, you know, you did up an interesting little story, actually a song that kind of plays the refrain for this little conversation we're having here. And Heather has it queued up. Heather, why don't you play the clip, and then afterward we'll pick up on it and talk about how wonderful the lyrics of this little song are.
I don't want no eggnog, lactose ain't for me. I don't need new pants, then again, TBD. Don't want any gifts this Christmas, it's true. All I want for Christmas is, don't want a Surface tablet, that one's pretty clear. Don't want that new book by Martin Bashir. There's only one thing I want, yes, it's true. All I want for Christmas is you. No ladder or printing of billions of dollars a month to be stocked, cause it's causing our dollar to rapidly inflate. I tell you, it's killing us. All of this open-ended fiscal stimulus, risk underpricing and rampant inflation, resulting in capital misallocation. And all I want this holiday season is an end to quantitative easing. Now, Santa, I know you get this a lot. Those children's letters, concernedly fraught. But I'll tell you what I want and save you some pains. I take the candy, you can keep the canes. Presents under the tree, the Fed's starting to taper. Cause only one of them should be covered in short-term paper. Don't want anything else for Christmas, it's true. All I want for Christmas is you. Deformity in the mandate of the Federal Reform, the whole thing will start over instead. Because I ain't a pro, but I really don't think that it's my CDOs with some dough from an inch at the year. Home run records were obliterated. That was the last time we saw bonds so inflated. And all I want this holiday season, all I want this holiday season, all I want this holiday season is an end to quantitative easing.
All I want this season is an end of quantitative easing. Although I like the line better that he says, I'll take the candy, you can keep the cane. I thought that was really good.
Yeah, I thought it was delightful. It's so rare that you get any kind of a musical rendition is particularly well done is that one that's talking about something so obscure as quantitative easing.
Yeah. It was a monitoring system song. My goodness, that was something. I'll have to put that in the archives.
Yeah, oh, and of course, he gets at all of the jargon, and I don't know how many people are going to recognize all of the different terminology fits in there, but it's on YouTube, and if people watch, it's got the lyrics showing on the screen so they can see it. And it's Remy, All I Want for Christmas.
So everybody can sing along. I don't know if you can do that. It doesn't really have much of a chorus, but well, what the heck. Hey, it's fun, you know. Speaking of fun, they've been having fun on Capitol Hill. They did a little bit of inquiry into digital currencies. I guess digital currencies have become so important that you know, the legislature, or at least certain members of the legislature, feel like they need to investigate it. And that was actually a while back, and it really didn't get any attention, so we're giving it a little attention now.
Yeah, well, I happened to see it on C-SPAN. It was a replay of a Senate Homeland Security Committee meeting, and they had several people that were involved in Bitcoin and connected with it. And we've been talking about this a few weeks back, about whether or not there was any Bitcoin competition. And so it encouraged me to do a little bit of research, and there were several different Bitcoin competitors that had very similar characteristics, Liberty Reserve, E-Gold, Zero Coin. But the government, to make the long story short, basically shut them all down because they allegedly were laundering money. That's a key thing. There was terrorist money that was going through these various accounts and so on. So they used the Know Your Customer, Patriot Act, you know, FBI, IRS, everybody else that's involved with financial stuff got involved and shut it down like they did Silk Road a few weeks ago.
Yeah, the thing that occurs to me about that hearing is the hearing probably was more about, you know, what do we do to justify the fact that we just confiscated $33.6 million worth of Bitcoin?
Yeah. Bitcoin was 170,000 Bitcoins valued at $117 million. Yeah.
That's something like that.
Value. Yeah. What the Bitcoin people were trying to say was, you know, you got all these regulations and so on. You know, at least tell us what they are so we can figure out how to comply with them. Because there's so many. Like I say, there's clauses under money laundering, which just means that they aren't tracing where the money's going. There are confiscations and seizures that the government wants to do and they can't do it because of Bitcoin. There's financing for terrorism that's allegedly going on. Well, because the government has a hard time monitoring all these transactions, nobody can comply with the laws the way they're written. So basically the hearing was saying, you know, please give us a break. You know, instead of just wiping us out, give us some reasonable regulations and we'll try to comply.
So, well, obviously they haven't read Ayn Rand, who pointed out that the laws are not written so that people can remain innocent. They're written so that people can be declared guilty.
Exactly. Yeah, and we also were a bit confused about whether or not Bitcoin was a copyrighted name. In fact, it isn't. But a Bitcoin Foundation was formed in 2012, and they are now filed as a nonprofit corporation, as a 501c6. And so they are trying to get the name Bitcoin copyrighted or patented, or rather it's a trademark, service mark, whatever, whatever legal provisions there are.
They're trying for whatever they can get, but they aren't going to get any of it, so it doesn't matter.
I don't think they're going to get any of it either. I think that you know, Bitcoin is going to have a very short life just because nobody's going to be able to comply with the laws.
Speaking of people who might have short lives, Edward Snowden's been in the news.
No, that's a new name.
He's got a lot of attention. First of all, he delivered a Christmas message, and it was a very warm Christmas message that basically says that he wanted to warn everybody about the loss of privacy. I guess he was basically talking to those people who hadn't read all the previous messages of his that had been published all around the world. I don't know, maybe they missed the message, I don't know. But he wanted to warn everybody about that. I thought that was really nice of him.
Yeah, well, and the other sweet thing, his message, was he said, we've already won.
Yeah.
I've accomplished what I set out to do, which was just to present the information to the American people so it could be debated. We never would have had any of the debates we've had over the past, has it been 9 months almost now? I think it started in June or July. It never would have been open for discussion, political or otherwise, because the whole, you know, rigmarole was secret. And so now not only Americans, but a lot of people in a lot of other countries are very upset. So that's an achievement.
Well, plus also, the government doesn't like it when you compete with them. And in this case, the form of competition is declaring victory, because that's something that governments like to do. They like to go in, declare victory after they've accomplished nothing, and that way they can prove that they've done something. And here's Snowden doing the same thing. And that's got to be maddening if you're a policymaker.
Yeah. And you know, it's going to get the tactics that I don't know whether this was something that Snowden came up with or Glenn Greenwald or Laura Poitras, the two people that started talking with him. But they didn't do what WikiLeaks did with these diplomatic cables. WikiLeaks dumped out like 250,000 diplomatic cables that they gathered. There were all kinds of incriminating things in there, and all kinds of terrible activities of diplomats in the war on terror and economics and the whole shebang. But the problem was they dumped so much of it, there was just information overload. You know, the media skimmed off the top, you know, stories. This was years ago. So what they decided to do instead was to just put out one story a month or something in that range, and then let the institutions like the NSA and Clapper and Alexander and those guys deny it, and then put out another document that proved that they were lying. And then put out another document that says they're doing what they claimed they weren't doing in the first place, or that they weren't doing along the way. And so the latest thing is tapping into iPhones and computers directly. And this is a new release from Snowden about the TAO. And the TAO is, where is the description of what this is? Transaction something, something, something. Anyway, what they're doing is they're intercepting shipments of computers and apparently iPhones, implanting them with viruses that service up all of the information going through that phone or that computer to the NSA. So they can go in and defeat any kind of encryption you might have on your computer, or get any, you know, sounds that they want to get, or turn on the camera without turning on the light, and they get a direct feed into your computer. And, of course, when they do that, it's purely accidental if you're not a terrorist. I mean, they're looking for terrorists, so it's just an incidental fact that they can tap into all these computers and iPhones directly. But it's all pre-encryption. They're getting keyboard strokes, they're getting audio and video directly from the computer that has this bug built in by the NSA.
The TAO, by the way, the acronym stands for the Office of Tailored Access Operations. How's that for a name? I mean, that sounds like it's right off a bureaucrat's desk.
We
Tailored
should be able to think
Access
of a different
operations.
There it is. I see it. We should think of something different. Tau, you know, it's like the ski slope of privacy rights.
Well, it's actually the Tau of government. Yeah.
The Tau of government.
Interesting also to see what the reactions to Snowden have been, particularly at year-end. Year-end, of course, is when news publications basically run out of things to write about. So they do their end-of-year summaries and New Year predictions and all that kind of stuff. And just a couple of them to pull out of the air, so to speak. ZDNet put out an editorial piece, whatever, by Larry Zeltzer, who writes for Zero Day at ZDNet. And he basically tried to engage in ad hominems to defeat Edward Snowden. His headline is, Snowden is sometimes irrational and sometimes hysterical. And the basis of his hystericalness, whatever the word is,
hysteria.
Hysteria, there's the word. The basis of his hysteria is that he starts off with a nice enough message, which is that the whole situation of Snowden's revelations have basically been, as you said, mission accomplished, that they have succeeded in leaking the NSA documents that have started the debate on the practices he's exposed. And Seltzer agrees that's certainly what he's done. But then he says that he gets carried away when he says, quote, "A child born today will grow up with no conception of privacy at all. They'll never know what it means to have a private moment to themselves, an unrecorded, unanalyzed thought. And that's a problem because privacy matters. Privacy is what allows us to determine who we are and who we want to be." Now, Seltzer reads that and he says, that's just, he thinks that's craziness. I'm not sure if I can find the exact quote. But he says, when you read the words carefully, he says that someone will be recording and analyzing our every thought, that this is, they put a chip in my brain stuff. That some people just get plain nuts about privacy, and clearly Snowden is one of them. Frankly, he says, it makes me all the more angry at the NSA for doing such a miserable non-job at screening trusted workers. Nothing about the revelations we've heard so far justifies the dystopian future Snowden predicts. Well, I find that rather interesting that he thinks that. I mean, basically, he's dismissing the idea of the chip in the head. Now, Google, this past year, came out with an experimental product called Google Glass, which is basically glasses that you wear that have a computer built in. That's about as close as you're going to get to the next step, which is where you actually have a computer inside your head, because it's so much more convenient. You have the computer in your head. It's tied into your visual system and to your auditory system and so forth, so that you can actually interact with a computer and with the world at the same time, and no one actually can see you doing that. Well, that's technology that's coming. This isn't like sci-fi stuff anymore. That was sci-fi stuff 40 years ago. But today, that's actually on the way. I mean, they currently now have computers that allow people, for instance, who can't see, to now see using a computer interface hooked into their eye socket, essentially. I mean, how much closer to chip in the head do you want to be before you say, yeah, chip in the head is coming? It's not like it's a maybe. We know it's coming.
Yeah.
Then he comes out with this thing about, you know, well, this is chip in the head stuff. Well, so what? What's the big deal here? Of course, it's chip in the head stuff. But why is that a shocker to him?
Yeah. The NSA had hoped from the very beginning that this story would be all about Snowden, and they would be able to use ad hominem attacks against every word he used, every idea he expressed, instead of being about what the NSA is doing. And so very early on, is another component of their tactic was that Snowden didn't give any interviews. He didn't, you know, show up on CBS and get lambasted and stuff like that. He just let the facts speak for themselves. And that probably irritated the NSA and the politicians who support it much more than anything else. So as soon as Snowden starts talking, whether it's to, I think he was actually addressing a British committee via Skype or something. So the more they get of Snowden, the more they can divert people from the facts of the matter of what the NSA is doing and focus them on Snowden as a person.
I guess then we can return the favor, and we'll do it with Larry Seltzer, who's now a Snowden critic, because Seltzer's the guy who made this rather crazy statement that anyone who thinks that there's ever going to be a chip in your brain is nuts. Well, sorry, Larry, but you're the one who's nuts. And by the way, you should know better, because in your About Larry Seltzer box at the bottom of your article, it says Larry Seltzer has long been a recognized expert in technology with a focus on mobile technology and security in recent years. Mobile technology. Guess what, Larry? The most mobile technology you can have is a chip in your brain.
Well, I don't want to poo-poo the point you're making, which I agree with. But actually, in fact, most of the brain research that's being done right now is not inside the brain. It's external sensors outside the brain that have feedback capabilities and can affect the brain.
The first computer didn't fit inside a little box. The first computer filled the whole room because it just couldn't fit it all inside a little box.
Yeah, there's no doubt it's coming, but it's still medically very dangerous to start implanting things inside your skull.
It's not going to happen.
Like I said, I don't just disagree with your point. It will come eventually. But like I say, what they're trying to do is they're trying to, you know, paint Snowden as a kook, and he's crazy. He doesn't know what he's talking about, and obviously anything that he released, you have to consider the product of a warped mind. That's the argument. So that they get that opportunity. In fact, what has happened among the general public is that the support for Snowden is just going up and up and up and up and up. The more and more and more that he, you know, his documents are revealed. There are a lot of organizations that had Person of the Year or Most Influential Person of the Year, whatever the category was, and they literally got tens of thousands of nominations for Snowden. He swamped everybody else. So I expect he's going to be the notable one for the next week in terms of media recognition.
And those leaders of public thought, the New York Times, have decided that once again they're going to follow the popular path and decide that all of a sudden they believe that Edward Snowden is actually a whistleblower. They even said so.
That's fascinating.
They said so yesterday.
Yeah.
Took them seven months to say it, but, you know.
Yeah, well, and you know, it's there are a lot of these media organizations that are so enamored and subservient to anything the Obama administration does that it takes them a long, long time to come around to say, well, you know, Obama is doing this, and he's, okay, he's prosecuted more whistleblowers than any other president in U.S. history. He's threatening treason charges against people who haven't committed anything even remotely similar to treason. So it takes them a little while to get their heads together and discover that Snowden isn't the devil, and maybe somebody in the NSA is the devil. They have to have this, you know, devil-angel conflict going on, and usually they take the side that's most amenable to them and most willing to give them secret information, you know, undercover, that they can release to the world. Packaged in such a way that's beneficial to the government. And so they haven't been exactly connected on the Snowden thing, and I suppose they've been irritated that they haven't been the ones. Even though, you know, Snowden first contacted the New York Times, said, I've got a lot of documents you might find interesting. They said, no, thanks, we're not interested.
Yeah, they didn't jump onto the bandwagon until they realized, oh, yeah, this is actually going to play.
I mean, the other organization that surely deserves a lot of acclaim is The Guardian in Britain, that they were willing to publish Glenn Greenwald's disclosures on the NSA and the Snoop group at the British headquarters, General Communications Headquarters, GCHQ, whatever. They stuck their neck out, and then, you know, the spy boys came down and forced them to destroy some of their computers and stuff like that. So they were pretty courageous to have released all this information.
By the way, I do have to take one little swipe at the New York Times besides their slowness in getting this, taking this position, this enlightened position that Edward Snowden is a whistleblower. In the same article, they also cited the fact that Snowden stole this material from the NSA, and that therefore maybe he needs to face some reduced charges rather than the full-fledged charges that the authorities want him to face. I think it's rather ironic that they're saying that, because let's be perfectly honest, the NSA stole this information from us. I mean, you know, what is their crime to steal information that's already been stolen?
Why doesn't treason apply to violations of the Fourth Amendment?
Yeah. I mean, it's just such a silly argument that the other side makes. They make it all the time, and they'll continue to make it. But this whole notion that he stole material, come on. This, the government has stole it from the very beginning, and blaming Snowden for stealing it better is just ridiculous.
Well, you know, and there have been some legal analysis on the disposed charges, and it's true that he signed a confidentiality agreement. And the violation for violating this particular agreement is you get fired. I mean, there's minor, you know, hand slap.
I think that's already happened. I'm pretty sure he doesn't work for the NSA anymore.
I don't know whether he's been fired or not. They'd probably love to have him back.
He's fired immediately. I'll reassure you.
But what they do is they go into all these provisions of law dealing with espionage. Espionage has always been a foreign agent breaking into U.S. computers, stealing information, keeping it secret, and giving it back to this foreign government so they can use it for their benefit. Well, it has no correlation to anything that Snowden has done.
No.
So it's a ridiculous charge. They have to inflate the charges to make it sound really serious.
Well, we're halfway through the show. Let's take a break, and then we'll pick up on more of the NSA fun and games after the break. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. We're back here on Freedom News at Hour, Surviving Meltdown, Walton Bill on this Thursday evening. And Bill, you talked a little bit before the break, among other things, about how the NSA had been implanting bugs deliberately into new equipment. But, of course, that's not the only NSA-related story that's come out, other than all this conversation about Edward Snowden. There's also the fact that the FBI has been using FISA data relatively frequently. In fact, almost continuously, and it's really gotten very little attention, which is kind of amazing.
Well, one of the claims in response to the Snowden revelations is that all of this, even if it's bad, even if it's, you know, we're doing things not quite right and we need to fix it and so on and so forth, we're catching terrorists. We're getting those bad guys. And the NSA has come up with, I think it was 5 or 7 different cases, some of which they've disclosed the details on. They've all been debunked. It had nothing whatever to do with their mass collection. So now there's a different aspect that came out as a consequence of ACLU suit against NSA. And it was specifically against the FISA court. And this is the court that approves all the wiretapping and internet tapping and so on. So it turns out that they got notification that the FBI has been getting, you know, these bulk authorizations from the FISA court every 90 days for the past 7 years to collect all the billing records and metadata and even, you know, contents of telephone calls and internet communications. And what the ACLU points out, and this is a point I've been trying to make over the past year or two on this show and elsewhere, is that the FBI uses this information not to find terrorists, but to create terrorists.
And that's a really important point.
Yeah,
that's a really, really important point.
What the ACLU says, quote them, in many cases, and it may actually be all the cases, the government agent provides all the instrumentalities of the crime. They choose the target. They design the plot, and then they solicit, because of this communications information they have, gullible subjects, offer them financial support and other incentives to carry out the plot. And, of course, then when it comes down to the actual, you know, plot execution, these usually immature, partially insane people who are amenable to this kind of thing are handed a fake bomb. And they go and they pull the button and then they arrest him. And so you get this fantastic, you know, plot that was hatched, making no mention whatsoever of how much the FBI assisted, aided, and abetted this plot, and then make a big stink about how efficient they are and how effective they are in stopping all this terrorism. It's just a game. It's just one more agency, and I'm sure there are others that are taking advantage of all of this security legislation, FISA court and so on, in order to just fabricate what they consider justification for doing it. So that's probably the most irritating thing for me about all of the stuff that's going on.
It is irritating. Well, it's not only irritating, it's also kind of frightening. I mean, earlier I made a joke about Ayn Rand in relation to the Bitcoin people and how they haven't read the fact that Rand pointed out that government makes these laws in such a way not so that you can be innocent, but so that they can find you guilty. And I was making a joke about it, and we laughed about it. But this is an example of how that's actually real world. It isn't just a joke. It isn't just something funny, that, you know, something to make fun of something that Rand said or something like that. This is real world. This is the government justifying its existence by luring people into criminal activity so that they can claim, ha, we've stopped yet another terrorist threat. And not only is it nonsense, not only is it frighteningly obvious to anyone who isn't gullible, but it's a setup. It's a setup for even more and more steps beyond the line, so to speak. I mean, it's not like the government ever gets to a particular point, takes these steps over the line, and then just stops there. They just keep going. They keep, getting involved in more and more obviously wrongful acts, obviously wrongful situations. And the next step, it's kind of like drug abuse, right? The old argument about drug abuse, if you start off with marijuana, you end up with heroin usage and whatever. Of course, now you end up with legalization in Colorado, but that's another thing. But seriously, the same kind of concept really does apply in the world of government. The more that government gets away with being able to turn people into criminals the way that you just described, the more free they feel to be able to do that, and the more widely they apply that, until finally they're applying it to all their political enemies. And that is a really serious threat to everyone's liberty.
Which is not to say that there aren't actual real terrorists out there. I mean, we did have 9/11. We had the bombing of the World Trade Center before that by the blind sheik. But you look at all the other cases of supposed, things could be terrorized as characterized as terrorism. Flying a plane in the IRS building in Houston. The shooter at Fort Hood, who was an actual Army, official who was in the psychology department explaining why Sharia law required him to oppose the U.S. government, even though he was a member of the military. So you get into all these things, and it's just so crazy that they could not have detected the actual plots themselves. But they can create plots and fabricate plots and make the pretense that they are protecting us from future criminal acts. They have never, ever been able to do that. When there are other people who are doing, serious plotting and causing various terrorist attacks, not just here, but anywhere in the world, it's almost never the case that any police agency has any idea what's coming down.
And if you think for a second that it's really nothing more than a Keystone Cops kind of situation, and certainly there are going to be people who will say that, I'd like to bring up an article that I don't know if you had a chance to read it, Bill. I sent you a link about it just before the show, but you probably didn't have a chance to look at it. And I'm kind of taking it out of order here from what our normal agenda would be. But this is an article that appeared at a website appropriately called Cracked.com, but it's an article, a very serious one, called 7 Reasons the TSA Sucks. And it's written by Robert Evans, who is basically the ghostwriter on it, and Rafi Saleh. Now, who's Rafi Saleh? Well, he's actually a man who's been in charge of security at the most dangerous airport in the world. That's the one in Tel Aviv, Israel. And he basically takes the TSA for task for being incompetent, which is a really interesting claim. Let me read a few paragraphs from this, because this is quite fascinating stuff. This was published December 21st, 2013. You can find it at crack.com. And he says, for a bunch of people in snappy uniforms patting down crotches, the TSA is remarkably unpopular. Nobody likes going through security at the airport, but you probably figured most of it had a point. All those hours spent in line with other shoeless travelers are a necessary precursor to safe flying. It's annoying, but at least it wards off terrorism. Well, he says, that's all bullshit. The TSA couldn't protect you from a 6-year-old with a water balloon. What are my qualifications for saying that? Well, my name is Rafi Saleh, and I was the head of security for the world's safest airport. Here's what your people are doing wrong. He says, first point, the TSA is supposed to regulate itself. He says, I went to meet with Joe Lieberman back when he was the chairman of the Committee on Homeland Security. Lieberman asked me to write a 1-page letter to Congress and the Senate outlining America's major problems with airport security. I told him the biggest issue was that the TSA is a regulatory agency and a security agency. They essentially make their own rules. No one else, not the FBI, not the CIA, not anyone but a loose cannon New York cop gets to do that. Lieberman and a colleague of his named John Mica pushed an opt-out program for airports in the Aviation and Security Act. The problem was the TSA needed to write standards and regulations for this program, and they just weren't doing it. So I went to Kip Hawley, head of the TSA, and said, look, my company and I helped write the regulations for the Israeli security agency at Ben-Gurion Airport. Let us help you. And he said, no, we've got all this covered. It's just a matter of time. I said, bullshit. You don't know shit about airport security. Fast forward to today.
Yeah, and he goes on many points that have been made by other people about how totally incompetent TSA is and how totally useless and superfluous everything that they're doing at the airports is you know, not just incompetent, but actually self-destructive.
Oh, yeah. Let me continue here because there's more to stuff here. That same point, he says, fast forward to today, and after years of delay, the TSA is finally almost ready to start processing all those pending opt-out requests after only a dozen years. So that's point number one he brings up. The point number two he brings up, actually, he's numbered them 7 and 6. He's doing one of these countdown things. So his point number six, politics play a larger role than you think. He says, remember those full-body scanners that leak naked pictures of random citizens all over the Internet? The last ones were removed earlier this year, but did you ever wonder how those things were approved in the first place? But he says, blame Michael Chertoff, former Secretary of Homeland Security and head of the Chertoff Group, which in 2010 represented a little company named Rapiscan. In addition to sounding like Rapey Scan, Rapiscan was in the business of making full-body scanners. Chertoff stood in front of Congress, his friends and former coworkers, and explained that these scanners were the future of security. And he neglected to add the future of me getting very, very rich and horrible. Congress listened, and for the first time, they mandated a piece of equipment for use in American airports. Remember, these were politicians with no security credentials. They decided Chertoff was an honorable man and went along with everything he said. That's where this whole scanning thing came from. It came from a bunch of politicians saying, well, that sounds like a good idea.
Yeah,
it's Keystone Cop stuff.
Yeah, and it goes on and on and on like that. My only disappointment was in Crack Magazine, which is noted for its humor. But this wasn't humorous at all. I mean, it was straight.
Well, it is humorous.
Critique.
It's humor of the ghastly kind. I mean, it's humor in the same sense of people who laugh at crashes at the races.
Yeah.
It really is. It's the same kind of thing. It's humor that you shouldn't even have to laugh at it, but if you don't laugh at it, you're going to go throw up, so you might as well laugh at it.
And they only spent like maybe $600 million. It wasn't even $1 billion that they spent on those scanners, and they're all in a warehouse somewhere now because they haven't, you know, totally ineffective and people didn't want anything to do with them. But take into account the billions, literally billions, of cigarette lighters and pocket knives and all the other things they've confiscated, which they sell in an equivalent of eBay to private companies to recycle, none of those had any effect whatsoever on any kind of terrorist threat. And the only terrorist threat we've had that had any kind of correlation to what you might take on an airplane was the Christmas bomber. And he had the stuff in his shoes. Well, guess what? Nothing the TSA does prevents that kind of plastic explosive from being recognized in a shoe. And I think
that's
that
right.
Was one of his other points that he made.
Well, they have nothing. He made a bulk of these points. Like you said, he tells one really poignant story of his own experience going through TSA security in Newark. And let me read this one to you. He says, I was at an airport in Newark once when a TSA searched my bags, turned up a laser pointer pen I'd been given as a gift at a conference. They told me they had to confiscate it because apparently laser pointers are just a couple hundred degrees away from being the new box cutters. Many of you have probably lost trinkets and gadgets in the same way, as you just pointed out, Bill. Now, would you like to know how to get them back? This is the interesting part, right? Supposedly they're capturing all this stuff to protect us. Well, he tells the handler, okay, take it, but that pen is company property, so I'm going to need some sort of receipt. He says, what? I said, well, the pen isn't owned by me. My boss is going to need some proof that you took it. So he calls his supervisor and asks, where do we keep the receipts? His supervisor says, what the fuck are you talking about? We don't give receipts. He explains the situation. His boss asks, what's the contraband? It's a little laser pointer. Give it the fuck back. What do you care? 2 seconds go by, and he hands it back to me. It's as easy as that. I mean, Keystone Cops. It's ridiculous.
Well, it's not only that. I mean, I don't know whether it's a division of the FBI or somebody else that does a test almost every month on one TSA facility at that particular airport. I've been doing it for years on end. And in 90% of the instances where they tried to get contraband through the TSA, they succeeded. And these reports are published, and everybody that knows anything about the TSA does not know anything about these reports, because they go to the Congress, and no newspaper wants to make the TSA look like a fool, because they get a lot of tips from the TSA and so on and so forth. And people actually believe that the TSA is protecting them. And this FBI investigative unit, whichever it is, has proven every month for the past four or five, six, how many years has it been in effect now, that it's totally ineffective.
It is totally ineffective, and it's still being passed off as if it were effective. And that's the part that's probably scarier than anything else. The fact that people continue to buy into the idea that this is actually protecting them, and it's not. I mean, don't forget about the fact that it's a complete violation of your rights, that it's a violation of the Constitution, of the Bill of Rights. Keep remembering that too. But if you're going to argue, as the people on the other side do, that this is all about protecting America, then shouldn't it actually protect us? That's the thing. It should actually protect us. If you're going to throw rights out the window, then what you're trading that for should actually work. But it doesn't. It doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one of the other stories that we had kind of sitting on the sidelines is related to protecting us. I don't recall. I think this was a Snowden revelation. The NSA signed a contract with a company called RSA, which is just the initials of the founders. They paid them $10 million to advise corporations on their security and what kind of encryption they should use. Well, the NSA paid them $10 million to put in an encryption formula that they could break through a back door. The NSA code name for the project was Bull Run. Who knows where they came up with that? But here's a theoretically trusted security, private security company that's advising corporations all around the U.S., and they're getting paid off by an NSA to put in fake cryptography. Can't say that word. Into their own security facility. So it's not just faking that they're protecting us from this and that, but they're paying other people to fake them into believing that their security is secure, that they're actually doing something worthwhile to protect themselves. And, of course, that isn't happening.
And I'm going to take this little discussion one step further. One of the arguments that was made way, way, way back about why it is we need to have spy rings, why it is we need to have NSAs and TSAs and all this other kind of stuff, is to protect us. It's all about national defense. It's all about national security. And one of the arguments that was used even at the very beginning by a very small minority against all this stuff was that, well, it's going to be basically open season on individual rights. Basically, everybody's individual rights are going to eventually disappear, as has happened, and we're going to get nothing out of it in return. Well, not only has that happened, not only has that come true, but it's come true with a vengeance. It's now gotten to the point where we really can't say we're getting anything out of all this. The only people who are getting anything out of it are the people who are in power, and they're getting it through their connections through the military-industrial complex and all the money that's being made there. But the rest of us are getting screwed. We're getting hosed. and it's funny, but it's also very disturbing how easily we gave this away, all in the name of finding out what the other guys are doing, because that would protect us. Well, look where it has taken us.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of people
where we're not protected at all. In fact, I would argue that we are less protected than where we were before the CIA was created.
Well, there are a lot of people who are apologists for defenders of the NSA program. When you break down their rhetoric, basically they're very unhappy that 1984 came so late.
Yeah.
They consider 1984 an ideal situation where they have maximum control, maximum knowledge, total awareness of everything that's going on in society, and society has no idea what they're doing. So they're applauding the 1984 idea of society being controlled by government in secrecy, which leads into an interesting thing that the apologists and the defenders of NSA have been using for some time, for at least a year or two, and that is a document that the NSA put together with talking points, and Al Jazeera. And not a U.S. company, but Al Jazeera used the Freedom of Information Act to get the NSA talking points. And it's like six pages of all these little phrases that you'll hear coming out of the lips of Dianne Feinstein and Mike Rogers and all the apologists, the generals and the commanders and all these people. And it's word for word. They are repeating the talking points the NSA has handed to them. Now, it's fascinating to go through all of these, you know, talking points that people are supposed to get across, which were not published by the NSA, but marked as confidential, if not top secret, and passed around to everybody that was on their side, saying, here's all the points you need to make. Now, if you want to go to Al Jazeera and see NSA talking points, you can read them all. It's kind of fascinating. But there was one in particular that stung me because it was totally false. There are hundreds of falsehoods throughout it and misrepresentations and so on. But one of the statements that they wanted people to say was, to be clear, under FISA, in order to target the contact of U.S. persons' communication anywhere in the world, NSA requires a finding of probable cause under a specific court order. Of course, they do not require that. Probable cause is a phrase from the Fourth Amendment. They do not use that. They haven't used that for the past 10 years at least. They don't use probable cause. They use articulable suspicion. In other words, if they can come up with a story that persuades a secret judge in a secret court that they have some suspicion that's not necessarily reasonable, it's not probable cause, it's just that they can talk about what their suspicions are, then they have full rights to violate anybody's constitutional rights anywhere they want. So that was just one that stuck in my craw.
Yeah, that's a big one. There's no doubt about that. I also want to take a moment here to kind of take a swipe at public education. And you may wonder, why public education? What possible connection does that have to all this? Well, one of the arguments that has been made for well over a century now by the staunchest advocates of public education is that you need to have public education so that the people can be indoctrinated with the basic principles that govern this country, that the country was founded on, the history and so forth. And it's a form of propagandizing, but they figure it's justified because you're teaching people to be patriots. You're teaching people what's right about America and what's so good about us and why we're different and the shining light of the world and all that kind of stuff. And what we've seen is that people have gone through the public education system for generations now, and they've come out the other end, and who are the people coming out the other end who have come out at the top of their classes? Well, they're the ones who end up in these high government positions. I mean, in order to get into these positions, you have to have the credentials. You have to be top of the class. You have to be the brainy ones. They basically utterly and totally failed to teach these people the principles that the country was founded on in such a way that those people absorbed and acted on those principles. In fact, they worked exactly diametrically against them. They worked the opposite of what those principles stand for. So, I mean, if there's ever a need in anyone's mind to even begin to wonder whether or not public education has been a good thing or a bad thing, I would point to the fact that we have created this huge army of leaders, and I would call it an army advisedly, an army of leaders who are basically taking the position that anything that violates individual rights, the very things this country was founded on, is a good thing because, as you pointed out, it gets us closer to the ideal goal of 1984. So much for public education.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, all of the measurements that you can possibly do for educational achievement and academic achievement, the U.S. has fallen, I don't know, from something like second place down to like 40th place. whether it's literacy. Well, literacy is the one where they're good. But in terms of any other measure of educational competence, it's fallen down to like 30 or 40th place. And one of the things that results in is Pew Research does a poll every now and then, and they ask people whether or not they support the following 10 positions. Happens to be the Bill of Rights. And they show the percentage that support the First Amendment or the Second or Third or whatever it is. And it's amazing that and these are adults, these are presumably educated people, who don't agree with or don't understand what those Bill of Rights clauses refer to. They just don't know what they are. They can't figure out what they mean because the education system has never taught them about the Constitution, about the Bill of Rights, about the Declaration of Independence.
Or even worse, they don't care. That's even scarier.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. But, Bill, it has been a pleasure as usual.
You.
And we'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.